the week of August 28th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 333, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Ann Arbor, Michigan, in Nashville, Tennessee, in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
You sound like you are on tour, like you're a musician on tour.
Like the great late Juan Gabriel. Yes, I am on tour. I was headed to Ann Arbor, Michigan for a bar mitzvah, which I had a great time. I stopped at friends in Nashville along the way to break up the trip. Had a fabulous time, and I'm back here in Birmingham, Alabama, and filled with the milk of human kindness. You know, on our show, we do a lot of criticism and analysis, and we say, this is wrong, that is wrong, we're the only ones who know what's right. So it's nice to point out occasionally some of the great work that's done in the trade papers and the things that we read all the time. And we do read all these, you know, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, all these people constantly. So when we criticize, it's because we love. But Hollywood Reporter had a great cover story on little people in Hollywood.
So people like us then, you know.
No.
Okay.
Again, you're making jokes about little people. I don't know if that's really appropriate in this case. It's a very substantial, good story about the travails and difficult situation of making a living as an entertainer in Hollywood when you are a little person. What other people would once upon a time have called midgets or dwarfs or some other,
derogatory
term.
Yeah.
Nowadays, little people is the preferred term, or LPs. It's a really good, interesting story with a lot of coverage. This is why Hollywood Reporter has been winning awards, because of great, in-depth, well-reported feature stories like this one. And IndieWire has a great story about a battle over costume design. It was so good, I thought we'd talk about it. But all we do is say, and then they wrote this, and then they wrote that.
Yeah,
very complex, interesting story about a battle over costume designing. It's really terrific, and we have links in our show notes. You should check both of them out.
Well, unlike the story from IndieWire, which it would have been great to have the journalist on, we actually are going to be joined by a senior editor at New York Magazine and Vulture, Kevin Lincoln. He's going to be here to help us take a look at the movies that flopped at this summer's box office, and he's going to give us his predictions on which releases might suffer a similar fate as we round out the year. We'll also tell you how to purchase movie tickets for as little as $2.
Woo!
Yeah, at least in China, where online ticketing companies are offering hefty subsidies to moviegoers in their heated battle for market share. We'll also dip back into the audience figures from the recently completed Summer Olympics in Rio, hopefully for the last time. But this time around, you know, this is going to be different. We have some data about viewership in Europe, Canada, and elsewhere. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We pull our information from ComScore. We have a link in our show notes, and we also look at Variety, Hollywood Reporter, Box Office Mojo and Profits, The Numbers, LA Times, New York Times, you name it. Anywhere we can find information on worldwide releases, we get it. And the number one movie around the world, thank you, China, is Jason Bourne. It opened up in China, as did the number two movie, Ice Age. They both made a lot of money there. Jason Bourne is playing in 63 countries, but a big chunk of its money came from opening in China. It grossed $62 million over the weekend. That puts it at $350 million worldwide, which means this movie, which is officially budgeted at about $120 million, is a hit.
Yeah, I was actually trying to find the story of, I guess they did some post-3D conversion. Where they turned the movie into 3D for China.
Oh, did they?
Yes, and it made everybody sick in China.
No, you're exaggerating.
No, I mean, made moviegoers sick. I'm going to have to find it.
So they did a poor job or a quick slapdash job?
I think that's probably it, is that it just was not done very well and it made people sick.
People weren't literally throwing up. They were just get a little nauseous and got a headache and said, I don't like this.
Yeah, you know, I'll be honest. It was something that Patrick Von Sikoski, my partner in crime over at Celluloid Junkie, he posted to this. Chinese cinema goers complain shaky Jason Bourne, post-converted to 3D, makes them dizzy and is expensive.
It would be more fun if they actually did start throwing up. At number two is Ice Age Collision Course, also opening in China. Guess what? Your fortunes can turn when you open in the second or third biggest market in the world, right? You know, one big market can turn everything around. Ice Age, another $50 million. That's at $370 million. So that is a solid hit as well. At number three, Suicide Squad, another $30 million for the DC property, $635 million worldwide. At number four, the first of what is sure to be many films about the secret life of pets. That animated movie made $30 million. That's at $750 million worldwide.
You know, the sequel, though, you know, down the line, would it still be The Secret Life of Pets or the, you know, The Life of Pets that we all now know about?
It could be The Secret Life of Pets, Badger Exposed, or something like that. And number five is the big hit in North America. It's a horror flick called Don't Breathe, which cost about $10 million to make, and it opened to just under $30 million. So that is a very big success story for, well, Sony released it. Who's the company behind that movie?
Screen Gems.
Screen Gems, that's right.
You know, this was a movie that at South by Southwest, where the film debuted, it didn't even have a title. And Screen Gems picks it up, and it...
They said, hold your breath, we'll get back to you on what the title is.
Exactly, almost literally. And sure enough, this movie is doing gangbusters. It got great reviews out of South by Southwest and seems to be doing quite well critically and financially upon its release.
That's right. It's one of a whole string of horror movies that have been modestly budgeted and really clicked with audiences. And number six is a more curious movie. It's Mechanic Resurrection. It's a vehicle starring Jason Statham, who's made a lot of successful movies worldwide. It was a modest grosser worldwide, the original Mechanic. I thought they dodged a bullet, but instead they doubled down and made a sequel. And the results are not great on opening weekend, $13 million. We'll have to see where it ends up, of course, and it's a $40 million budget. But that was a curious decision to go forward with that one. And number seven is War Dogs, another $12 million. That movie has just about matched its budget worldwide at $42 million. And number eight is the raunchy moms movie, Bad Moms. Another $12 million over the weekend, $125 million worldwide.
That's a hit. I mean, I think STX has a hit on their hands.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what back end people got for the, for that movie. It's going to be just fine. It'll never make a profit, though, of course.
No.
not as far as the accountants are concerned.
No, it's already so far in the red that they, you know, they may have to shut down the studio, in fact.
And, of course, Ben-Hur has the opposite problem. It will never show a profit, even in people's minds. $10 million over the weekend, $41 million worldwide. Falling hard in the countries where it's already playing. It's in about 36 territories. This definitely has some... You know, it has some money to make around the world. It's got half the world to open up in at least, but it's going to be a hard slog for that one.
Yeah, in this case, they literally might have to shut down MGM over it.
And number 10 is Pete's Dragon. I thought this one would be doing better. Another $10 million over the weekend. It's at $76 million worldwide, and it's going to really need overseas because I thought this movie would show better legs in North America because, like, Don't Breathe, it got very good reviews.
You know, I think, you know, this movie opened in North America in August, which used
is
to be...
fine.
Yeah, no, but what I'm about to say is it used to be considered summer, and everybody, all the kids would go back to school after Labor Day. Well, for a number of machinations, including, you know, the AP advanced placement tests and scheduling, that date of Labor Day has been moving up more and more into the middle and early August. So here
you mean the date that kids go back to school?
Yes.
Labor Day doesn't change, but the date kids go back to school has been getting earlier and earlier. Yeah, everybody I know is back in college or high school already.
It's remarkable. I mean, it's like summer is just June and July, and really just July because in August...
Well, it's really May.
Right.
Summer has, you know...
Well, so... That said, I think in hindsight, Pete's Dragon would have been a better release in October after everybody's back to school and into their rhythm and their routines. They can actually go out and, you know, see a movie after they've gone back to school and after they've kind of gotten used to the new school year.
So if you've got a kid-centric movie, maybe August isn't the time to start.
It used to be, but not anymore.
Yeah. At number 11 is another horror flick, Lights Out. $10 million. It's now at $125 million worldwide. Another family film that needs a little love. It's Kubo and the Two Strings. $9 million over the weekend, $27 million worldwide. That's not true for Sausage Party, which is doing just fine. It's not for the kids, though the kids will try and sneak in and see it. $9 million over the weekend, $88 million worldwide. It's quadrupled its $20 million budget and raised a ruckus among non-union members of who work on animation in Canada, which is where the movie was made. We've talked about that story.
Actually, we didn't.
We were going to last week.
But then, yeah, later in this episode, stay tuned, we will be talking about that.
And number 14 is Star Trek Beyond, $7 million. That's at $250 million worldwide, which is a far cry from what they need. Overseas has to pick up the slack. And number 15 is Finding Dory, $6 million over the weekend. $930 million worldwide. I don't know why I care, but I keep thinking, I want Finding Dory and The Jungle Book to get to $1 billion. Just because those records seem to be falling faster than ever, and it's well within shot. So, you know, it could happen. We'll have to see where it ends up.
Well, right underneath that is another movie, The Shallows. Okay, this movie cost $17 million. It comes in 16 worldwide this week. Worldwide, this movie has made $93 million.
And hopefully given a big boost to Blake Lively, who gives a really good performance. She holds the screen for the whole movie as just a person trapped with sharks circling.
Yeah, literally, she holds on like for dear life on the rock. Yeah,
absolutely. And moving way down, we'll look at one more movie. It's Hell or High Water seems to be a good success story. That's a movie that expanded even further in North America. The best reviewed movie of the summer, I would say. $3.7 million over the weekend. It stars Chris Pine, Ben Foster, and Jeff Bridges, among others. And it's at $8.5 million. It's only playing here in North America, but it's gotten great reviews. It's a classic old school platform release. It's nice to see that it's building word of mouth. People are saying, hey, that movie is good. So hopefully that'll keep working for that one. I bet. We hear about that certainly at the end of the year among critics awards. I don't know if it'll make the Oscars, but it's certainly going to be in play for New York, LA, and some other critics.
Well, you know, at number 17, I know we're backing up a bit, and I only mention this because I was flipping through the Los Angeles Times on Friday, and there was a review for Tunnel. And you might recall this is the South Korean drama, which, you know, the guy survives in a collapsed tunnel for 35 days, improbably, of course. But there was a full-fledged review of this movie. It's only playing in one theater in Los Angeles. I don't know, maybe it's playing in New York as well, but here in LA, it's in one theater. And these movies are being reviewed now, which is a good thing. I'm saying this is all as a compliment, I suppose, to the Los Angeles Times for taking it seriously and reviewing the film.
Well, you know, it used to be the rule at the New York Times that you would review every single film released in New York. And they finally abandoned that rule, like literally this year.
And LA Times, too. You're right.
It's just not possible.
Yeah, it really isn't. And it used to be that, well, even the Academy, they said, you know, unless you get a documentary reviewed by the New York Times or the LA Times, then you can submit yourself for, you know, best documentary. That was their way of cutting down on the number of documentaries being submitted. And you know, it used to be that people would release a film in New York. They'd pay for it to be released in New York to get that review from the New York Times. And these were vanity releases. And so the New York Times just said, you know what? Why are we spending money covering all these things? And they just stopped. Same with the LA Times.
Well, they didn't stop until recently. And it was only because there were too many movies. It wasn't because of the four-walling. It was simply because there are too many. They would have had to have 15 people on staff reviewing movies every week. They just, you know, there are more than 1,000 movies released in New York City in a year, and they just didn't have enough critics to do it, and they couldn't afford to have enough critics to do it. So it was really a practical decision, not a rebellion against the four-walling of documentary films that hoped to get an Oscar nomination. But, you know, there's lots of debate back and forth in New York and LA and Hollywood about what to release when, why, and how. We see the same thing happening in China, don't we?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because when you were telling me about this story, I said, you know, everything you're saying sounds like you could be talking about North America or Europe. I mean, basically, it's tempting to think that China always acts with like this one voice and one intention since it's kind of a one-party country and not kind of. It is a one-party country. Essentially, it's a totalitarian totalitarian government.
You just did.
Yes. I have to slow down, though, whenever I say it. However, you know, a country with more than a billion people and a huge economy is sure to have competing interests, even within that government. And that's why we have Chinese state-owned media speaking out against the Chinese state-owned movie boards blocking Hollywood movies.
Yeah, this is hilarious. It was an editorial published in like Young People's China Youth Daily saying we should not have blackout periods against Hollywood movies. They only really referenced the summer, even though there were blackout periods in December towards the end of the year and Chinese New Year, which coming up will be in January 28th. So they only mentioned the summer, but they basically said there shouldn't be blackout periods as much for Hollywood movies. We've got to have more big movies all year round. And their argument was, you know, quote, it has never been officially confirmed, but is widely recognized that domestic films, meaning Chinese movies, are carefully protected from foreign competition every summer. And they said this isn't good because they can't even admit it exists. But they said it's not good because our movies need to be stronger and they need to compete in order to get better. And in a class, it sounds like something someone would write in a Hollywood screenplay. you know, some crazy aphorism, but they actually wrote, one cannot become a running champion by always racing with a snail. Similarly, domestic films cannot become powerful if they always fear the competition from foreign blockbusters. You can't be a running champion by racing with a snail. Tell that to that Turbo snail. What was that movie?
Turbo, in fact.
Turbo, yeah, tell it to him. You don't want to try to compete against him.
Well, can I translate this from the Chinese? Basically, this is movie theater owners saying, hey, give us more movies and spread them out throughout the entire year. Don't just give them to us like all clumped together in like 1 or 2 months. We want, you know, 1 or 2 great movies every week. And you know what? If that means a domestic local language movie goes up against a, you know, an American Hollywood movie, fine. We want that as movie theater owners. And on the flip side of that,
30,000 screens.
Yeah. And on the flip side of that, you've got the, you know, distributors and the producers saying, yeah, no, we're not going to do that because then, you know, our film wouldn't play as well. So no.
And a classic example this week, Jason Bourne and Ice Age both opened up on a Tuesday, just to limit them as much as possible and against each other, even though, of course, one is of more of a family film and the other one is more of an adult film to a degree. But up against each other in August on a Tuesday. That's why they made a lot of money this week, but they also opened up against each other. So you think, if one had opened up 3 weeks earlier, maybe they both could have done even better.
But the reality is we're never going to find out how much money we know how much money their movies are making in China. What we really don't know is how much audiences are paying for those movies.
Well, we've had stories in the past about corruption where they steer ticket sales to one movie, even though you tried to buy a ticket to see Jason Bourne, they let you into that movie, but they actually pay for a ticket to
a domestic movie.
Communism Forever, you know, some domestic film that they wanted to highlight or that the state-owned media was saying, hey, this is your movie. So that's been happening. What's happening now?
Well, Alibaba Pictures is... it's Alibaba Pictures Group, APG, as it's known. It's an offshoot of Alibaba. This is the big, like, Amazon-type service.
Of the world.
Yeah, of the world, but it kind of stems from China. It's, you know, was based in China. They have an online ticketing business called Taopiopio. I know I'm mispronouncing that, but it's an online ticketing business. It's a lot like, Fandango, movie tickets. In other countries, it would be Allocine or, you know, I don't know, you can buy tickets online. And what these companies in China are doing, there's a number of these companies, they are subsidizing the cost of tickets to consumers. So they will go out and buy all of the tickets for Jason Bourne in a given theater or two, and then offer them up to consumers on their apps, on their mobile phones, to buy for like $2 or, you know, $1.50 or $3.
Well, what would they normally pay in China, do you know?
$10.
$10 US for a ticket to a movie in China.
Roughly, yeah. I mean, you know, it
depends. That's obviously the national average,
I assume. Correct.
Just like in America, where it's... So they pay more than they do in North America.
Well, I don't necessarily know that. I would have to double check.
Well, our average is like $8.
Okay, I don't have this information, but let's just say it's not $2, okay? And there is a huge difference in the price that you can get on these online ticketing sites and ticketing services versus the going up to the box office.
So they're losing they buy a ticket for $8 and sell it for $2. They're losing $6 on that single ticket. What's their play?
Their play is gain the market share and then let the subsidies, you know, go by the wayside. And then they, you know, people will have to buy the tickets directly. So, you know, they'll have to pay
directly,
meaning they'll have to pay the higher price.
But I mean, how does that help how does that help the Alibaba ticketing agency?
It's kind of like what happened with Uber and Didi. These are the, you know, ride sharing companies. Didi and Uber were kind of locked in this market share battle, both subsidizing drivers and, you know, the rides that were being offered to customers, to a point where Uber just couldn't play that game anymore. They were losing billions of dollars. So effectively, it's who will run out of money first. And
so who are the two or three? So there's another ticketing agency that they're competing with.
Yes, there is.
Okay, so they're trying to drive them out of business.
Well, drive them out of business, or at least in the minds of consumers, make everybody believe that Taopiopio is the best place to go for tickets.
And how is that messing up the box office? Obviously, are they selling? Are they basically buying tickets they know they can resell?
Yes.
Or are they? All right. So that's not. So we have a. So.
So what's winding up happening is you'll play a film to an empty audience that has, it's a sold out audience.
Empty? No. Then they're not buying tickets that they know they'll resell.
Yes, they are buying tickets that they will resell. However,
that they know they will resell. I'm saying, are they buying tickets that they know there is demand for, or are they just buying tickets and whatever any dumb movie, and they don't care if they don't sell them again?
Well, there is the goal of trying to resell all of them and buying tickets to the popular films. At times, that doesn't necessarily work out. As, you know, now Alibaba Pictures lost $69 million during the last, I think it's quarter, in the 6 months to June. So,
but that's like a good marketing budget.
Yeah, so they lost that much money just in the subsidies alone.
Right, but again, that's if they're getting lots of people to come to their site and download their app and become their customer, that could pay off in the long term. If you consider that a marketing budget.
Yeah, it's customer acquisition cost.
Right, but their goal is not to buy tickets to movies that are failing or flopping and have empty and buy tickets to empty theaters. Their goal is to simply get customers to come to them first.
Correct.
So if there are empty movie theaters, that's just stupidity on their part in buying tickets to a movie that turned out not to be that popular.
Correct. That's a miscalculation where they said, oh, this is going to be popular, buy the entire theater, and then, oops, nope, didn't happen. And so
for most of the case, we assume that they're probably just buying tickets to big popular movies and reselling them at a discount.
Correct.
So we're not picturing empty movie theaters like that older story was of corruption where people didn't want to go see movie A. They wanted to see movie B, and the theater would literally print out a ticket to movie A and give the money to movie A, but then write the name of movie B and send them to that theater.
Correct.
So movie A is empty, even though nobody wanted to see it, and it's sold out, but it's empty because nobody bought a ticket to it.
Right.
So this isn't what we're talking about.
No, not at all.
All right. So, but this is them trying to beat out a competitor and selling tickets for a big discount. And now people, of course, are getting used to those low ticket prices, and they're going to be annoyed when tickets go back up higher, aren't they?
They most certainly are. Just like, you know, when Uber rides start costing what they should cost, people will start to be annoyed, and we'll see what happens, you know, to the Chinese box office when that occurs. The question that we have is, how much are moviegoers actually paying to see these movies?
Well, there are discounted movie tickets to the U.S. too, aren't there? I mean, buy
second run theaters, or you buy in bulk, yeah. No, I mean, I guess the question is this market being artificially sustained? We'll see.
And we're still waiting to see what's happening with the Olympics, aren't we?
Well, we kind of know Michael Phelps is going to win all the medals,
right?
You know that, yeah. So certainly the medal count is over. You know, which is one of those practices I hate, the counting of medals. And the games are over, but not the data flowing in from those games, not only from the United States and Canada, but from Europe and elsewhere. And we're talking about, once again, television viewing, which is no longer just television. It's actually television and live streaming and apps, and there's linear channels, and it's not just on one channel, it's on 15 of them, or in the case of NBC, 11. We're finally getting some numbers, not only from the U.S., but elsewhere.
That's right. We're finally getting a little more data on who offered what and advertised what and all that sort of stuff, because it's all dark and mysterious. We should know what NBC promised advertisers, and we finally found out they promised it would be as big, if not bigger, than London, which wasn't very smart because London was the highest rated, you know, Olympics in history outside of North America. And NBC said, well, yeah, but Rio is same time zone. It's practically like North America. To which I would say, if you have an Olympics in Mexico City or Toronto or Rio, it's still not the same as having it in New York City or LA.
Well, and what I love is, this is Mark Lazarus speaking. He is the chairman of NBC Sports. And I could just see the publicist cringing as he said this. Like, no, this is why we don't have you talk to the press. He says, and this is a quote, I woke up that first Saturday morning alarmed with the opening ceremony numbers. thought, oh, no, don't say stuff like that.
Well, they're down substantially from London. What are you going to say? I don't like it when people ignore reality.
Right. But, I understand that. But, you know, I'm just saying from the vantage point of a PR flack, you know, going, oh, God.
But they never should have promised the highest ratings ever for an overseas Olympics. That was just dumb. Or overseas, I should say, out of the U.S., you know, non-U.S. hosted country.
Well, so, and it appears that what they did was somewhat smart. They basically, and this is NBC, and we will get to, you know, other territories. They basically said, look, this particular Olympics will cost us about $1.2, $1.3 billion to put on.
We sold that many ads.
We will sell that much in advertising, holding back a whole bunch of ads that we can sell either during the games or at the very last minute. It turns out, while they did sell a few extra dollars worth of ads, they also held back some of those ads for make goods. during
the
games.
They always do that.
Yeah. Right?
So if you over promise, you can say you don't give them money back. You just say, well, here's an extra ad.
During
you'll
that
reach more
particular
eyeballs. Yeah. You make up. If you say you'll reach 20 million people and they do it by households and stuff, and you only reached 15 million people with your ad, they give you another ad and that gives you another X number of millions of people.
Yes.
So that's how the game is done. They never give back the money. That's not going back. So they broke even on these Olympics. They said it's the most successful Olympics ever, by which they mean, I guess, the highest grossing Olympics ever.
Yeah.
And they also say 10% of their revenue came from digital streaming. And that's, of course, much higher than ever before. So these Olympics are down from London, but they're only down 9% if you include cable and live streaming. That's a pretty modest drop. But the problem was NBC thought this will be just as big as if it's held in North America, in the U.S. And I guess it wasn't such a crazy thought because in Canada, they had the highest rated Summer Olympics in history.
And we have to thank Raul Buril for actually sending this in. He was the one who spotted this this story that the CBC, more Canadians watched the CBC Olympic coverage than ever before.
Right. And of course, Canada did great. They won lots of medals. It was a friendly time zone. And they had record ratings. But that's the very thing the NBC predicted for the U.S. They had lots of medals. They had a friendly time zone. They just did not have a record rating. We got a link to Rolling Stone complaining about why that is. You know, oh, they hate the coverage. They hate this. They hate the human interest. But, you know, all around the world, you're seeing Spain streaming in mobile was huge. You're seeing in Latin America, 55 million smartphones were streaming the games. Young people especially watched the games on their smartphone, literally watched the games on their smartphones. They were streaming events all the time on their iPhones and their Androids. So, the way people consume the games, not wanting to wait until it's prepackaged in prime time, billions of minutes were viewed online just in the U.S., and that's all being duplicated all over the world. So, like always, it shows all this changing technology, the Olympics and how we watch it changes. It's a huge, huge event. NBC just modestly overpromised how many eyeballs they would reach advertisers.
Well, and did you mention Spain?
I think I did. I mentioned it in there somewhere. They've got a lot of streaming and mobile there, too. We've got a link to a show notes in there about how they were watching the games. And streaming and mobile was really, really popular. Obviously, more than ever. You know, for all these things, you can say more than ever before. Because, you know, 8 years ago, you couldn't live stream the Olympics.
Right.
So, yeah.
And, just like Facebook had to figure out how they were going to change from making all their money through their website to making a good portion of their money on mobile, which is where people are accessing Facebook these days and predominantly, you know, Facebook had to contend with that and they succeeded. Well, NBC and all of these broadcasters throughout the world will have to figure out how they shift the advertising revenue from not only linear television, but to online streaming.
And they're doing it. 10% of their revenue already came from, online live streaming.
Right.
So that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, we do have actually a letter from a listener later. Do we want to read it now or should we just...
Is it related to this?
It's related to this and what
well,
we said last
week. Let's
do
it right now, I think.
Okay. Unfortunately, the person actually obscured their name, both in the email and, you know, in their email address. Michael Sperling. Long time.
Are they going to give us some? Is it Edward Snowden?
I think you'll see why.
Okay.
Long time listener here and needed to interject some corrections. On your last episode, you suggested that time shifted viewing, non live, could help significantly increase audience figures for the Olympic broadcast on NBC. Take it from someone on the inside, me, that simply has not been the case. The Olympics definitely gets a bigger boost from non live viewing than average sporting events like a baseball or football game, but rarely is it more than 3%, especially later in the Olympics when interest begins to wane. It might be a little different this year because of Bolt, and I assume he means like the Usain Bolt track and field stuff at the end of the Olympics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not saying this is, and I say he, it could be a she, not saying this is the reason such figures aren't reported regularly, that would be due to the availability of audience measurement data. Just saying that in the case of sporting events, there's almost never a huge bump and the Olympics doesn't change that drastically. I know the network will be holding a conference call to discuss final figures and data in about a month, and non-live viewing information will certainly be included. I'm sure you'll see when that happens. What I'm saying here is accurate. Non-live viewing. I thought that, isn't there another name for it? Like live plus 3, live plus 7, It's interesting that it's non-live viewing that keeps being referred to here. Non-live.
That must be the way they do it. You're not watching it live, which is what their golden standard is. They would love that. And we know that sporting events, live sporting events, obviously, that's one great thing. The Oscars, live sports, that draws in the audience. My argument was that, well, the primetime Olympics are not live.
Right.
That's what you get on the live streaming. It's primetime is rarely live. Sometimes the late evening volleyball, beach volleyball was live, but most of it is prepackaged stuff that happened earlier. So I thought maybe there would be more of a bump than you would expect from like the Super Bowl via DVR. But clearly this person's on the inside and they're saying that's not the case. Trust us. We'll find out in a month.
Well, and I would love to know, are certain specific moments higher than others, because they can actually tell you exactly what people went back to watch over again.
Well, yeah, they do that. And of course, nowadays that's skewed because you've got all the videos posted online. So instead of people taping it, going back and watching that particular moment, like the Tonga guy walking in during the opening ceremonies, in this case, it's probably people just go online and watch the YouTube video.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, that's where I went to see Shinzo Abe, the, I guess, prime minister or president of Japan. He showed up as Super Mario Brother.
Yeah,
I wanted to show my kids that. I went to YouTube. Well, and by the way, I should mention that the person who emailed us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, that's dirt@showbizsandbox.com, and Raul Buril actually sent his link in through our Facebook page. So we pay attention to not only our email inbox, but also our Facebook page. Thank you, Raul, and thank you, anonymous person who must work at NBC or be affiliated with the Olympics in some way, shape, or form. And, you know, we'll have to wait, as our anonymous writer says, for the full details, the full data. But we don't have to wait to find out what the big book of the week is over at bookfilter.com.
That's right. Bookfilter is a book lover's best friend. And
shameless plug.
That's right. And the big book of the week, the number one pick, is a young adult fantasy novel. It's the latest in the series by Saba Tahir, and it's called A Torch Against the Night. That is my number one pick. But for people listening to Showbiz Sandbox, I had to highlight another book more directly. It's a reissue of a memoir or a novel, depending on your point of view. It comes from the New York Review Books, which is a great imprint. They're like the Criterion Collection or the Rhino Records of books. When they put something out, you want to read it. And this book is called Slow Days, Fast Company by Eve Babbitts. It's a 1977 memoir/novel. It's a novelistic memoir or a memoirish novel. The names have been changed, in other words. And it's great. It is a classic, apparently. I've never even heard of it. But a lot of people have referenced this book over the years. She has got some other novels and nonfiction work. But it's just a glamorous, drug-soaked story of Hollywood and sex and threesomes and, you know, bacchanalia. But it's really well-written. It's like Valley of the Dolls written by Jane Austen. I mean, it's really smart. It's really observant. It's a really terrifically written book. I can't recommend it highly enough. If you're in Hollywood, you've probably heard of it already. But if you've never read it, it's a lot of fun and really good. So check it out.
It's autobiographical fiction. That's like military intelligence or...
Well, she was with, you know, it's like there's a great foreword for the book that demolishes the sort of double standard for women. When men drink hard and party, there are manly men like Ernest Hemingway and, you know, Charles Bukowski and you know, Jack Kerouac. But when women do it, they're flighty and silly and, you know, oh, you know, if men gossip, they're, you know, social observers, and when women gossip, they're gossipy women, you know. So there's been a lot of dismissiveness towards the book. It's not an erotic, you know, fantasia. It's just casually mentions certain, you know, sexual rondelays. And but she dated Jim Morrison, she dated Harrison Ford, she was friends with her, dated Steve Martin, she knew everybody and everyone, she designed album covers for rock bands like the Byrds and Linda Ronstadt, and she was going to do Janis Joplin, but she died. You know, I mean, she was everywhere. Everyone knew her. She's sexy. She's fun, but she's very smart and a terrific writer.
And once again, has a book on, I guess the same book, and you picked it as the book of the week for our listeners. That's called Slow Days, Fast Company.
That's right, and there's a link in our show notes. And obviously, the William Morris Endeavor Agency, they obviously listen to Showbiz Sandbox because we talk about how important, you know, books are as a source of properties for entertainment. And they've just acquired the literary agency Rabinow, Wachter, Sanford, and Gillette. And that company specializes in being sort of a pipeline from publishing to film and TV and stage properties. They're the hidden link for Girl on a Train, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, the HBO miniseries Olive Kitteridge, and a lot more authors and properties. So William Morris Endeavor purchased them.
Well, we'll have to wait to see, just how important that is. It does seem like it would be important, but I'll tell you, if they can make that transition into actually supplying their own titles, that would be a big deal.
I get it.
Yes, because it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, speaking of books, oops, CAA Honchos, Creative Artists Agency, had to tell staffers the new tell-all book Powerhouse was not, in fact, authorized or approved by them. And that's the name of the book, Powerhouse. You can wonder why people might think so, since almost everyone who ever held a major position at the company went on the record and is quoted in the 750-plus page oral history. Mind you, the top guys are really feeling it now that mid-level staffers have discovered top Turks Richard Lovett, Brian Lord, and Kevin Uvain all pocketed $20 million when TPG Capital made a second investment in the company in 2014. Oh, and they pocketed a second $20 million each from a secret discretionary fund controlled by Lovett and Lord.
They said, who should we give this money to? Us.
Yes, sweet. Not so sweet for the staffers who were told at the very same time, sorry about those bonuses and expense accounts you've been used to. We gotta cut back now that there are new people investing in us. To top it off, countless people in Hollywood can't be bothered to buy the book in the first place. Despite Hollywood decrying piracy of their movies and TV shows, PDFs of the book are circulating like wildfire. In fact, CAA had to admonish its agents and staff not to email PDFs of the book to each other. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's an internal power struggle, right? And angry people, you told us we couldn't have our bonus and you gave yourself a double bonus. But you know,
I mean, here's my question. You didn't think that was happening? I mean, who owned the agency beforehand? Who was benefiting the most? Those are the people benefiting the most when somebody comes in and makes a cash investment. So,
well, you know, CAA was not in charge of the book or authorized it because ICM is fielding inquiries about movie rights, which now makes you want to cast who should play Ovitz. I don't know, maybe it should be Travolta. But I mean, it was an oral history. If they didn't want it to happen, they could have just not cooperated. Right.
Yeah.
If you can't speak to anyone at CAA, you're not going to be able to do an oral history about CAA. So if they didn't want the book to happen, they should have just said no.
Yeah. Well, you know,
give me a break. If Saturday Night Live, those guys did the oral history of Saturday Night Live, it doesn't happen if Saturday Night Live doesn't cooperate.
Well, and I've talked to agents that have been working there for years, both, you know, ones that have gone and ones that, you know, were there before me, there after me, and don't work there anymore. And there was always this kind of uneasy feeling that the Young Turks and Lovett, Lord, and Huvain were among them, were always getting preferential treatment. So there was always that kind of frustration. And you saw it last year when 10 agents left CAA for UTA all at once and somewhat secretly, and it was a big to-do. And so you can feel that frustration is actually coming to fruition with moves like that.
Yeah, well, and a more positive story, Google is restoring Dennis Cooper's blog information to him. We talked about this before. Dennis Cooper's a fiction author. He pushes the envelope in terms of sex and violence, and he's had a decade-long blog on Blogger that created a community. And then Google suddenly out of nowhere took it down. Nobody could get an explanation of why. Change.org petitions were started, media stories were written, and finally, after a few weeks of hellish feeling that he was going to lose all this work from all these years, they finally have given him his stuff back to him. He's able to post it somewhere else, get it posted on some other site. So that's a happy ending to a story we talked about before.
Yeah, there was no reason for them not to do this.
Right, except, you know, you get 10 billion people. Anytime you kill a website, then they say, I want my stuff back. And they're like, you should have saved it yourself. You know, it's just save your blog information. You know, do a full, thorough downloading of all the info on your blog.
And I know you did that recently.
I did. Yeah, absolutely. After the story came out.
Two top executives have been named the new co-presidents of DreamWorks Animation. They are Bonnie Arnold and Murray Soraya. They'll report to Universal head Donna Langley. Margie Cohn will head the combined Universal and DreamWorks TV animation division. And that's how diversity happens. Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal, absolutely. I mean, that is really a changing era, isn't it? To see that many women in charge. And it happens because they're competent, they can do the job. but they get the opportunity even more so when there are other women above, below, and next to them.
And this is Comcast finally buying out DreamWorks Animation. That deal is closed and done.
Jeffrey Katzenberg got a sweet little $400 million and sent a tearful goodbye to everybody.
And he's out. Yeah, he's left. And Murray Soraya and Bonnie Arnold, they worked underneath Jeffrey Katzenberg at Disney many years ago in the 90s. So they are not animation newbies, that's for sure. They are very well-respected animation executives.
Cool. Well, since we've already been corrected on our mistakes or our beliefs of what will happen in DVR usage, we might as well continue with that thread.
Which, by the way, we like it when you correct us. We like it when you correct us.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's good to have the experts weigh in. And I did think perhaps that the sad, dreadful news that surrounding The Birth of a Nation, this upcoming movie, that the woman that was involved in the rape case that involved director Nate Parker and the co-screenwriter had committed suicide and that her family did not want to discuss this issue and they wanted privacy. I thought perhaps that might let that simmer down and go away and, you know, keep it from derailing what the studio and the director would like to see with this movie. That has been far from the case, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you have Penn State alumni and Nate Parker and Celestin, his co-writer, went to Penn State. They wrote a letter on Parker's behalf talking about the case.
They basically said, yeah, I know we were very concerned about rape, but you know what? This was a race issue, and this was the racist white cops trying to pin this on the black men. And this woman was mentally disturbed long before they came into the picture and, you know, had health and mental health issues, and they were like full bore on, you know, don't even think, you know, this is race. And it was a really strong, you know, to talk about riling up an issue. I don't know how much it would help him, frankly.
Yeah. I don't think it helped him at all. Just kept it alive. Meanwhile, over at the AFI, the American Film Institute, it's a pretty well-respected, film school, not only here in the United States, but the world. They were going to have a Q&A screening of Birth of a Nation with Nate Parker, and they canceled it and postponed it, supposedly, until later in the year.
Yeah, there was going to be the film and a Q&A, and that's what was the big problem. So they've replaced it with the new Jack Reacher film starring Tom Cruise. I guess it's safer to ask about Scientology than what's going on in this movie. There was a press conference in Toronto for the movie. That has been canceled at the Toronto International Film Festival. That won't happen. They'll show the movie, but they won't have a press conference. And now Nate Parker has given some new interviews. He spoke to Ebony magazine and started using phrases like male, toxic male, you know, privilege, and clearly buzzwords that he's been learning about to try and both educate himself perhaps and learn the best way to talk about this issue and criticize how he has dealt with it in the past. So this is far from ending. Is this going to happen to Casey Affleck? He had that ugly incident. I don't know how much was going on there. Certainly he was never gone to trial or anyone found guilty of anything, but that was an issue of violence. That is in his past, but now he's got a big movie coming out, Manchester by the Sea, Oscar and Oscar hopeful. Are people going to start feeling obligated to say, well, we got to talk about this?
Well, I don't necessarily know what the whole Casey Affleck. Oh, was this the thing from Sundance where he kind of pushed somebody?
He had that, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't necessarily know. I think that would have come out before now.
Well, it did come out. I mean, but will it be discussed again? Is it the sort
Maybe.
Of thing? You know,
maybe. I mean, I think, I don't know why, all of a sudden. Well, I do know why. I mean, it's because Nate Parker is finally kind of finding some recognition here and people are looking into his past.
And Casey Affleck was also sued by two former female co-workers for sexual harassment. And that case was settled out of court. So, again, there's nothing in the public record as such. But, you know, this is now a hot button issue, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
People do not want to look the other way.
They're certainly not.
But the question is, how do you deal with it? What's the best way? Can this movie, if just in a practical Hollywood term, can they just say, let's let the other actor step forward and you step back? I mean, he wrote, he directed, and he starred in it. It's hard. Wrote, produced, directed, and starred in it. It's hard to not have him be front and center on the film.
No, and he is basically the film. I mean, the whole story here is...
Well, there are great actors in it, so...
No, but I mean, the story, a promotional story here is, you know, here's a struggling actor, a guy who, you know, has been a journeyman in Hollywood for years, directs his first film, stars in his first, in his directorial
makes it
debut.
Happen, has a great success.
Yeah. And in the end, it's like the one strength that you have in your promotional campaign may be its biggest liability.
Right. And I thought it might perhaps settle down and die away. Not that I necessarily thought that was good or bad, but that was just what I thought might happen. Clearly, I was wrong.
Well, you mentioned earlier, Michael, that we were going to be talking about the animators behind Sausage Party. Workers of the world should unite, or at least workers of Vancouver who work in the animation industry. They should unite. We reported recently, which we didn't do, by the way, how animators on the film Sausage Party faced the same unfair pressures that dog the workers on many a film, whether it's a big budget studio item needing fancy special effects at the last minute, or, you know, a cheap, smaller independent film that wants, quote unquote, free overtime. On Sausage Party, the film was made in Vancouver, where most animation houses are not unionized. Animators were pressured to work overtime without pay, and those who objected say they were refused on-screen credit for their work. Now, a local labor union has filed a formal complaint against the animation house Nitrogen Studios. This raises the question, why are movies such lavish, big-budget affairs? Until it comes to paying the below-the-line workers. And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal because it's how people work in the movie industry all over the world. You're freelancers. Every movie is a new company. Every movie is a new project. And all the craftspeople who help make the movie happen are dependent on somebody hiring them again and again and again. So you never want to get in trouble for being, you know, difficult. And so you hesitate before you ask for that credit, or you hesitate and you don't want to make a fuss. And you're very vulnerable because they say, let's not work with him next time. There's plenty of other unit photographers who are available, plenty of other gaffers who are available. And that's how they exploit workers, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, the studio is always looking to lower overhead, and they do it at the expense of the vendors and the staff that they're using.
But it's just crazy. I mean, you're talking about all the time with visual effects and animators and people like this, where you hear stories of like, they're always coming and they're saying, oh, you know, you got to give us a cut, give us a break. You got to help us out here, right?
Right. Absolutely. I mean, they are always looking to, I mean, I have always said working for the studios as a vendor is like having cancer, because you never get paid more. You will always get paid less. So it's a matter of how long you can stay afloat while
how
working.
How is that like cancer?
Well, you know, you will eventually die.
Oh, okay.
Because, I mean, look at what happened with Rhythm and Hues. It's a classic example, and this is the same exact thing, where, you know, you pit two different animation studios against one another, or two different effects houses against one another, and then suddenly the companies are doing it for less than it actually costs to do the job, and the company files for bankruptcy.
Yep.
I mean, I've watched it happen on multiple levels, on multiple fronts. Not always, but a lot of times with these...
And Hollywood doesn't care because there'll be some new, young, hungry company to step in and take over the slack.
It's the same thing that used to be for you know, staff, where it's like, well, if you don't want to do it for nothing, I'll find the person standing behind you who will do it for nothing. Now it's the same thing with a lot of these vendors. If you don't want to give me, you know, if you don't want to do this job at below cost, I'll find the guy standing behind you or across town that will. And there usually is somebody who does it. They don't do it for long, but it doesn't matter most of the time.
Yeah.
Now, that brings us to Netflix. The streaming service Netflix expects to have 100 million subscribers by 2018. And not surprisingly, a majority of those 100 million subscribers will be outside the U.S. Western Europe is already the number two market for Netflix outside the U.S. But with expansion across the globe and a concurrent push to create at least some local content everywhere, Netflix is a truly international brand. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. Obviously, it changes everything in terms of their focus and the content that they create and how they see the market, because it's a worldwide market. You know, I still feel like the BBC is a valued worldwide brand. So is CNN, obviously. And then there are channels that you associate with your own country, like ABC and NBC for us in North America. Is it possible, though, to think of Netflix as like a worldwide channel, even beyond the sense that it's seen worldwide, in the sense that there's local content all over the world generated by Netflix, that might make people feel more of a link to it than they do when they watch something from, you know, ABC or the CNN or the BBC.
Yeah, that's exactly why they're doing it. I mean, let's face it, that is why they're doing it.
Well, they're doing what? Expanding worldwide? That's where
making local content.
To build that emotional connection? Well,
correct.
Some countries they have to, right, by law.
Well, correct. Yes, that's true, too. Or they could just purchase local content. But yes.
Yeah. But I feel like they're really becoming a worldwide brand. I don't know if I'm saying this right. I mean, BBC and CNN are worldwide brands.
Right.
But I feel like Netflix is feeling like it's our brand rather than that country's brand that I love and admire, which is what I would say about the BBC.
Correct. Hmm. You are saying it properly, as you just did. This next story, well, that didn't take long. We're still waiting to take a tour of Michael Jackson's Neverland, which will probably never happen, in fact. But starting this fall, Prince's Paisley Park compound will be open to the public for guided tours. No word on a dress code, but would it kill you to wear purple? Come on, people. And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, I guess, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, yeah, it's, he was planning to do this anyway. I mean, I was making jokes about in our show notes here to you when we were putting these stories together about, yeah, you know, who this is going to help is, you know, the family. But
that's right. But he was actually planning to sort of he was setting the groundwork for things like this after he was gone.
Yeah.
I mean, I know I have friends who've been in there because they've gone on the tour or they've gone for shows or whatever to Paisley Park. I would have loved to have gone when he was doing his, you know, late night shows. That would have been cool. But I don't know. I went to Graceland. I guess why not? Why won't I go there? Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty much exactly like Graceland, except instead of it being a house in Memphis, is a warehouse in Minneapolis.
Less tiger print.
Yes, exactly. No jungle room. Well, speaking of that didn't take long again, by the way. Recently, it was announced that Stacy Snyder would take over 20th Century Fox Film Studio in June of 2017. That's when the current head of Fox, Jim Giannopoulos, the well-respected head of Fox, he's going to see his contract expire and, you know, they were going to kind of give Stacy Snyder the throne. To the surprise of precisely, well, no one. The lame duck head is not waiting until next summer, but will in fact be stepping down in the next few days. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop, unless he does actually get a throne. Is it an actual throne?
I don't think so.
Like Trump's golden throne? Does she have an actual throne?
I don't know and don't think so.
She could probably get one if she wanted it.
That's probably true. She already got the head job. So, you know, I kind of made a joke that, you know, Lachlan and the other brother, James and Lachlan Murdoch, who are now kind of the CEO and executive chairman over at 21st Century Fox, you know, they got rid of Roger Ailes and now they're getting rid of Jim Giannopoulos. I would not feel very safe if I was a senior executive over there right now.
Well, he was already out the door, though, before they stepped in, right?
No.
Was that part of their new strategy?
That was kind of part of their new strategy.
So let's get going on this. Come on.
Yeah. And now there's talk about Giannopoulos, who, as I mentioned, well-respected, well-liked guy. You know, Paramount needs some help. Warner Brothers needs a head. There's some talk that, look, though he's of retirement age, it doesn't necessarily mean he's going to retire. More than likely, he'll pull an Alan Horn and go from Warner Brothers to Disney, in this case, Fox to Paramount or Fox to Warner Brothers.
What does Hollywood consider retirement age?
Well, I'm just saying I'm going by Social Security age, 65. Well, our next story, Michael, we're going to head to Latin America. In fact, to Brazil, where the Olympics just took place. But in this case, we're going to be talking about Aquarius. This was a film that I saw in Cannes by Kleber Mendonça. Oh, you know, I can never pronounce this person's name. Do you know how to pronounce it, Michael?
Nope.
Mendonça Filho. Kleber Mendonça Filho. He directed this film. I believe it's his second film, Aquarius. It stars Sonia Braga. And, you know, it got fairly decent reviews out of Cannes. Didn't win anything. But now there's some, ballyhoo, some controversy surrounding the release of the film, at least according to the film's director.
Well, what's the deal? What's happening? Because it's obviously Brazil has a government in exile and there's a very big political battles over who's in power in the country, the impeachment of the head of the country. And he apparently has fallen on the wrong side of this issue in terms of getting his movie put forward for the Oscars.
Right. Okay. So I did a horrible job of explaining this. And that is why we sometimes write these down, almost always write these down beforehand. But yes, so during Cannes, he and his, you know, castmates and crew climbed the red carpet there in France with these signs saying, you know, oh, this is a coup d'etat, a political coup d'etat, that Dilma Rousseff, the president at the time, was basically impeached, or she is about to be impeached this week, in fact. She was voted out. There was an interim president put in, and they felt, gee, this is a coup. And the, you know, it would be like the Democrats ousting a Republican or vice versa and then taking over the office. And that's what's happening. It happened in May. It's going to happen, be finished off this week. And
the fallout for the filmmakers is that the people in charge of choosing which film to put forward as Brazil's official entry for best foreign language film are people who are not happy with his support of the ousted leader.
Or the fact that he's so public about it, certainly. And then they, I guess the people who do select which film gets put forth for the Oscars, mostly filmmakers and producers and artists, except this one guy, Marcos Petruccelli, who is a critic who actually is a critic of Philo. So he there's some feeling like this is all being rigged as well. The film is being released in Brazil this week. And instead of getting 16 plus, which is what most films get that deal with drug and explicit sex, which this film does have in it, it got 18 plus, which is another way of limiting how many people can see it.
Right. And let's be clear. Almost always there are politics involved in which movie gets submitted for which country.
Oh,
it's
absolutely.
Rarely a group of cineasts who say this is the best film. It's very who's in favor with the government, who, you know, that sort of thing. So this is not anything new. But it is, you know, unfortunate for these filmmakers and their movie.
Yeah, I mean, and it's worth seeing. I mean, it's got some very subtle, you know, subtle.
Is it one of your best films of the year?
It's up there right now. Yes.
Oh, okay, great.
But well, you know,
check it out.
I don't expect it to be in the top 10, but I happen to like it specifically because I know a lot about what's going on in Brazil and the culture.
Cool.
Well, Michael, that brings us to the end of Big Deal or Big Whoop, and moves us along into our popular segment, Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And Michael, I know you hate this, that somehow the box office this summer was seen as a big disappointment and that there were several flops. Well, here to tell us not only about the flops from this past summer, but hopefully a few ones, well, we don't want to wish flops on people, but more than likely there will be one or two. Kevin Lincoln, a senior editor of New York Magazine and Vulture, he's here to discuss about seven films of the fall with big budgets that look like question marks. Kevin, thank you for joining us.
So, Kevin, I'm really glad that you're focusing on movie by movie. You're looking at the fall and you're sort of handicapping the big new movies. You're giving a pass to a few of them, like Star Wars and the new Pixar animated movie Moana. You figure, well, those are going to make money. And you look at the movies that aren't such obvious hits and say, how well do you think they'll do? And I think that's really the only thing that matters, isn't it? If you look at the summer box office, who cares if it's up or down? What matters is, what movies did you release? How much did they cost? And how much money did they make, right?
Right, yeah. I think that, you know, people get really absorbed in sort of the whole picture and the, you know, what studios release what movies and how the summer is doing as a whole. But like at the end of the day, people really attach themselves to particular movies. And I think you definitely have a few movies that are coming out later in the year that have way more wattage than most of the stuff we were getting this summer, you know. And you have to imagine Doctor Strange is a Marvel movie, like Civil War. It's going to do pretty well. Although I think there is the chance that Doctor Strange could be a low-end Marvel movie, but that still means like $500 million worldwide. Star Wars, you know, until we are given a reason not to, you have to assume that that's going to be huge, especially in the heels of Force Awakens, and especially if it turns out well. Kind of a similar deal with Fantastic Beasts.
And this is the Harry Potter kind of follow-on. It's like a prequel.
Right, exactly. So the question there is, does it scan as a Harry Potter movie to a wide audience? I think that Warner Brothers is going to make sure that it does. But people just, you know, people love Harry Potter. The new book that came out in the play form was a huge bestseller. So again, that looks like almost a guaranteed hit. So you're looking at, you know, the movies that are not so established as part of a huge successful franchise, or like Moana, just, you know, an animated movie, which tend to be doing really, really well right now. And that left me with about seven.
Well, before we talk about the seven, some of which we've already mentioned, can we take a look back at this past summer? Because yeah, as much as Michael doesn't like to talk about flops or, and I'm
what
putting,
are you talking about? I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm putting words in his mouth.
Were there movies that you made predictions of? I think we all saw The Legend of Tarzan and Ben-Hur as maybe question marks. Certainly Ghostbusters had a lot of bad buzz for various good and bad reasons. But are there movies that you predicted would do well that flop? Was there anyone that you thought would click that somehow didn't, or vice versa?
Yes, actually there was one that I really, that I kind of got wrong, because I did a story, let me pull it up. I did a story trying to predict the five highest grossing movies of the summer. Mm-hmm. And what you find is that I did pretty well with like Finding Dory. But I thought that Ghostbusters was going to do a little better than it did just because of the wide, you know, how big of a story it was in the conversation. Mm-hmm. It ended up making sense in the aftermath. But the big one that surprised me was the BFG. Yeah. It was a the BFG was a disaster. It only grossed, I think, like $55 million in the United States. It cost well into the nine figures to make. And it just was it didn't connect anywhere. And basically, I was kind of looking at that as like this summer's attempt to be, you know, Alice Through the Looking Glass, just this effects-driven sort of childhood resonant movie directed by a, you know, big budget auteur. You know, Alice was a Tim Burton movie, BFG was Spielberg, but it didn't connect with anyone. It didn't connect with kids, it didn't connect with adults. And so that was the one that like really caught me off guard. I think again it sort of makes sense in retrospect. And I think if the movie was, you know, I don't know how you guys feel about the BFG. I think if it was better, it would have done better.
That always helps.
You said it, not me, but yes, yeah. I would agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, let me ask you this. I mean, do you think that people, you got Alice Through the Looking Glass. I mean, BFG was kind of, I suppose you could call it original, though it was based on a Roald Dahl book. I mean, I look at Alice Through the Looking Glass and others of that ilk and just think, wow, we've really seen this before. We don't need to see it again. Are audiences just tiring of sequels and prequels and just deciding, you know what, I'm going to stay home and watch Stranger Things on Netflix?
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. People just don't care about these movies. And to make a movie for $150 million and to make it a financial success, you need a lot of people to care. And people feel like they've seen these things before. You know, you look at the movies that ended up doing well this summer, it was movies that were either, you know,
they're all sequels or part of a franchise. It's Captain America Civil War, Finding Dory, The Jungle Book, a movie based on an app, the Angry Birds movie, X-Men Apocalypse. These are all sequels. Now You See Me 2, Jason Bourne, Ice Age Collision Course, Suicide Squad. They're all franchises.
Right. But the difference with those is I think they fit into franchises that have much more resonance as a whole. You know, everybody really cares about the MCU. With Finding Dory, it didn't really feel like a sequel because it was so long since the first one came out. And so people were actually hungering for that movie. Suicide Squad, I think, was driven by an intense level of curiosity and, you know, a dedication to DC. I wonder how much longer that's going to last because they keep making terrible movies. But yeah, you are seeing, you know, the reality of the situation is that people are getting tired of sequels, but sequels are also the only thing that the studios are giving them. So people will go and see certain sequels. Also, The Secret Life of Pets. I mean, animation did really, really well this summer.
Yes, absolutely. Especially modestly budgeted animation. That's a big story that you don't have to spend $200 million on your movie in order to have a hit like The Secret Life of Pets.
Right, right. Although Moana did cost, you know, I think, well, based on what Frozen cost, which was about $150 million, you have to assume that Moana is probably in that range too. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, whether that hits on the level of some of the big successes from the summer. Same with Trolls, which, you know, I'm not the target audience. So,
well, that moves us into the fall predictions. You have seven movies listed that are not slam dunks, and that are movies that we're going to talk about and whether they're going to work or not. Trolls is the first one. That's based on the dolls on top of a pencil. Is that where Trolls began? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my main association with it is they had the big pointy hair, you know, that was many different colors. But that movie is pretty star-studded. They did a big unrolling of it at Cannes, I think, where they had a big publicity stunt with like Justin Timberlake and Anna Kendrick. You know, they are counting on that to be the big animated feature of the fall. And so I just think that any movie that is based on such a sort of dormant piece of intellectual property, you have to ask whether it's really going to hit. But it is as about as safe as you can get with a movie that you don't know for sure, just because it is animated. You know, it is directed towards children and families who do go to the movies. Again, though, I think that it'll help if Trolls is good. Some movies don't have to be good, but I think if Trolls isn't good, you know, people might just be like, well, I don't really care about these little things that you put on the top of your pencil, you know?
So memo to Hollywood, make good movies if you want to make money.
Well, that's, I think that's an interesting thing that sort of gets forgotten, is that like, when these movies are good, they usually don't flop. Most of the movies that flopped this summer weren't very good. And most of the movies that did well, you know, they were better. They were generally the better movies that were coming out, and not all of them. And Suicide Squad is a good example of that. That was a movie that wasn't well received, but did really well. But it was well received among teenagers. And so, you know, as much as people like to talk about sequels and they like to talk about intellectual property and they like to talk about people being tired of these movies, like, good movies, people still go see good movies. And the movies that kind of surprised everyone, you know, got a bump from that. And I think that, like, Civil War obviously is a great example of that. People liked it and it was huge. And it could have been a medium-sized Marvel movie, but it did big numbers worldwide because people were really into it.
I mean, if you look at the 9 movies that flopped in the summer, all of them got bad reviews. The only one that didn't, is the jury's still out on whether it'll be a flop, but it's Pete's Dragon. That got pretty good reviews, and it may be rescued by overseas box office and become a hit. For the moment, it's underperforming.
Pete's Dragon is one of those, you know, they knew that that was going to be a tough sell, I think, from the start, just because it isn't as based on that familiar of a property. And I think the fact that it out well is why people went to see it at all, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and Ben-Hur being the biggest flop of the summer, if not the year right now, I was talking to, well, somebody at MGM who said, well, maybe we should have taken a hint when we couldn't find anybody to star in the lead role. And Jack Huston, who auditioned for the other role, the side character, actually wound up taking the role because they just couldn't find anybody willing to take the movie.
Yeah, that's rough.
So that moves us into the second movie of the fall. It's Passengers. It's a sci-fi movie starring Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence. So that's obviously a star-studded movie right there, and they're going to appear on screen, unlike the voices in Trolls.
Right.
Well, and that's like a two-hander. That's kind of like Gravity, where you have two people in space that are kind of on their own.
Right. And I think Gravity is probably the best comp. You know, I think Gravity is much more effects-driven and was more of a spectacle. But Passengers is still kind of like in that. It's a space movie, so you've got to put it up against Gravity. You've got to put it up against Interstellar. But the big draw there is Jennifer Lawrence. You know, people generally go to see Jennifer Lawrence movies. Joy was not a success, so I think that proved, you know, she still has to be in the right kind of movies. You know, she's not – this isn't the 1990s. People don't just exclusively go to see actors anymore. But if that movie is as good as it seems like it could be, then they're going to be competing in the award season, and it's going to be something that people are talking about. So I have a high level of confidence in Passengers. And just the fact that Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence are both on board gives you the idea that this script is pretty good. You know, it's like, there's some credibility there. And the guy who wrote it, John Spates, wrote Prometheus, which, you know, people have very mixed opinions on, but is at least an ambitious movie.
And this is a big budget movie, $150 million.
Right, right. So there is some, and Morton Tilden had some big success with The Imitation Game. Yeah, I think it's just going to become a question of how the movie turns out. But any movie that isn't in a franchise now, you have to at least raise the question of whether people are going to go see it. Because as much as everybody wants Hollywood to be making more original movies and original sci-fi movies, they still don't do that well usually. And so this has a chance. This and Denis Villeneuve's Arrival have the chance to buck that trend a little bit. Arrival was made for much, much less money than Passengers was, though. So that has probably a better – like Sicario, Villeneuve's previous movie, that has a good chance of just being a solid return on investment.
And this is another alien kind of space movie. Well, it's not, I guess it takes place where? Here. So it's sci-fi, so to speak.
Right, right. And yeah, you know, a better comp for Arrival might be something like Ex Machina, where it's sort of a brainy sci-fi movie with good actors and a
You just lost your pitch. Brainy sci-fi. The studio just said no thank you.
Yeah. What else do you have? What about Inferno? This would be the third in the whole Da Vinci Code franchise. Stars Tom Hanks, who will be up against himself playing Captain Sully. But this is the third, Angels and Demons, I guess, was the second, and now we have Inferno.
Yeah, I mean, there was a huge drop. Da Vinci Code was a big hit worldwide. It made $758 million a few years ago, and so that was a really big performer. Angels and Demons only did $486 worldwide, so, like, you're already looking at kind of a big drop-off in terms of what that franchise is doing. But that being said, Tom Hanks as the Robert Langdon role in a Dan Brown movie, you know, this one has a bit of a hookier premise than Angels and Demons. I think you have to assume that it's got a good shot at the $500 million mark. And these days, if you can make $500 million worldwide with a movie that isn't, you know, Marvel or DC or a comic book movie, you're not going to be too upset. So, that being said, though, if people just aren't interested in this part and this story, it could be a big loser for Sony.
Well, what about Magnificent Seven?
It doesn't have to be good. That's certainly the case, right? Because Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons both had, you know, terrible reviews.
Yeah, this franchise has never been good, but neither are the books that they're based on. You know, in the kind of conventional idea of the word "good," which is like
as in not crappy,
reviewed. Right? Exactly. So we'll see. But yeah, The Magnificent Seven's a really interesting one because it's coming out, you know, and the next three movies we're about to talk about are all coming out in September, which is historically one of the weakest months on the calendar. And Magnificent Seven was expensive. It cost about $100 million. And, you know, that's a star-packed movie, but to perform in that genre, the Western, you know, you generally have to really kind of excite the public in a certain way, because that's a genre that people already have very preconceived notions about. So if you make Django Unchained, everybody's like, wow, you know, this is something I haven't seen before. I think the question with Magnificent Seven is if people are just going to be like, I've seen this movie, you know, like, I don't know that I need to see this movie again.
Well, okay, so we're talking about a Western directed by Antoine Fuqua, starring Denzel Washington, Chris Pratt, Ethan Hawke, and others. It's a remake.
Of course, it's a remake of The Magnificent Seven, which is a remake of Seven Samurai. But most people haven't seen those movies.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, and I don't know. I think the trailer's great. I'm excited. A Western feels like a fresh new thing. But of course, people who like Westerns always say that. But they can work sometimes. And this looks like a fun, poppy movie with a really big all-star cast led by Denzel, who's very strong box office. So I feel very confident this one is going to click, even though it is a Western, and that makes it more of a question mark.
Deepwater Horizon, though, does not look like it's going to. I mean, to me, I saw the trailer and some footage from this and just thought, wow, I don't know if I want to see this.
Yeah, I'm a little mystified by this, actually. I just don't know what made anyone think that the Deepwater Horizon story was so compelling that it merited a $150 million movie.
And this is about the oil spill that took place in the Gulf of Mexico in 2000, I believe, 11.
Right, yeah, a few years ago. So it's still fresh in mind, but I think what Lionsgate with Deepwater Horizon is that it'll play to the same audience that American Sniper played to. You know, this sort of red state, blue collar audience that is into these sort of heroic narratives. And Mark Wahlberg does tend to do pretty well. He is a solid box office draw. I am skeptical because these types of true life disaster stories usually come out in the summer. Putting it out in September at that price point, I just, and again, it's like directed by Peter Berg. I don't know that is that appealing of a product to most people. I'm certainly not.
Is it directed by Peter Berg or J.C. Shandor? I got confused.
Peter Berg. It was initially supposed to be directed by J.C. Shandor, but then.
Oh, that's right. Well, Peter Berg has a great track record of making unexpected movies work out, hasn't he?
Yes, especially around water. Just ask him about Battleship.
Well, that's the one exception.
Yeah, I mean, Lone Survivor did pretty well, but Lone Survivor, I think, only costs like $40 million. I mean, if Deepwater Horizon costs $50 or $60 million, I'd be way more optimistic. Mm-hmm. $150 million is a huge budget for a movie like this.
Well, I'm not sure how much Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children cost. The trailer is quite interesting. And this is a Tim Burton film and is based on the novel. This one, you say, could go either way.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Alice number one, that made $1 billion worldwide, as unbelievable as that is. And Tim Burton does have a certain touch when he works in this sort of fantastical, child-directed kind of CGI-heavy world. And the big question mark for me is whether Miss Peregrine is a big enough draw. I don't know that much about the source material, but it does have – you know, shades of the BFG to me as a possible, you know, as something that people are going to decide whether to go see or not. But if people see it more as like an Alice and it kind of gets everyone excited and seems like a good family movie, you know, it could work. If it's terrible, which Tim Burton has done a few times recently, then that's going to be really hard to overcome though.
And then finally, we have Assassin's Creed starring Michael Fassbender. This is based on the video game directed by Justin Kurzel. I wish I could like participate in a conversation about this film, but literally I have not only no idea really where to start with this film, I have no desire to even see it.
You've never played the video game?
No, I have not.
You're a loser. Well, it's directed by Justin Kurzel, who worked with Fassbender on Macbeth. So you've got a really arty director trying to grow up into a popcorn movie. How much luck is he going to have?
This is the one that I'm like really fascinated by for similar reasons. I like Justin Kurzel a lot. I loved Macbeth. I think Fassbender is great. I just don't get why this was the movie they wanted to make. I haven't played the video game either. I know it's very popular, but video game movies, you know, if this movie hits, it'll be really the first huge video game movie in the United States.
What about that
Angry Birds movie?
Yeah, the Angry Birds.
Yeah, I guess the first based on a console game and not something that you play on the subway.
Okay.
Maybe. you know, I don't want to rule it out because it is produced by New Regency, which tends to have a magic touch. And it does have Fassbender. Like Fassbender and Kurzel are involved for a reason. Michael Fassbender doesn't have to do anything. But then again, you know, the road to hell is paved with movie stars making terrible video game adaptations. So it's like, I don't know for sure whether just his involvement means it's going to be good. And the price point, again, it's not New Regency. Said it's not $200 million, which the president of Ubisoft said was what it cost, which if this movie had cost $200 million, then somebody should be fired no matter how much it ended up making. But it still like costs $130 million, which is expensive. And I think the most interesting thing is that it's coming out the weekend after Rogue One. Oh. And Force Awakens made $150 million on its second weekend. So it's probably safe to assume Rogue One isn't going to do quite the numbers that Force Awakens did. But still, if you're going up against Rogue One on weekend number two, that's like going up against most huge movies on their first weekend. And you just have to assume that that's going to be a big competitor for a movie like this. Like, I just don't know that there's enough business to go around.
Yeah, it almost seems like one of those movies that if you're going to go to the cinema, you probably haven't been in a week or two. You're not going to see this movie. You're going to go see Rogue One.
Right. And if you went and saw Rogue One the week before, you're probably not like, well, I want to go back to the movies to see Michael Fassbender jump off like some Spanish tower during the Inquisition. It just is like, it's a very weird pitch.
There have been some video games, of course, turned into hits, like the Resident Evil franchise. I think that was a video game that turned into multiple movies.
Right.
And Warcraft. Did not make any money in the U.S., but worldwide, Warcraft was a very big success story. It made $430 million worldwide, so that was a big gamble, and it paid off. So if Assassin's Creed doesn't click in the U.S., maybe it will click worldwide.
Yeah, and I think that could be the saving grace. It could do very well worldwide, and I think if it does, you know, any business here, everybody will be pretty happy considering all of the things that are going up against it. But, you know, we'll see. It should be a pretty interesting season in terms of these movies.
Okay, you've given us some smart opinions about why some would work and why they might not work, but we're going to put you on the grill now here. Hit or flop, Trolls?
I'm going to say hit.
Passengers?
Hit.
Inferno?
Flop.
Magnificent Seven?
I'm going to say flop, but we'll
no!
see.
Deepwater Horizon?
Flop.
Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. I've read the book.
Is it good?
It is pretty good. It's all right.
Hit.
And Assassin's Creed?
Flop.
Flop. All right. Well, hopefully we'll have you on again some other time to talk about how well you did here and how well you're going to do next summer or come holiday time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope that all of these movies are hits. I want every movie to succeed.
Even if they're bad?
Well, not if they're bad. I hope that everybody gets what they, you know, have earned through their hard work.
Well, Kevin Lincoln, a senior editor at New York Magazine and Vulture, will place links to your work in our show notes and, of course, to your Twitter account. Everybody has one these days. We always have to place links to it. Thank you very much for joining us and for going through not only the flops that were, but the flops that might be.
Thank you guys for having me.
Well, that was cool of him to stop by. We'll have to see how he does. I would say, you know, with these movies, most of them are not original. The only ones that are original are Passengers and Deepwater Horizon.
Well, you know, which is
the rest
based
are all
on a,
based yeah. on properties.
And Deepwater Horizons is based on a true life story.
Well, I didn't say it was pulled out of thin air, but yes, but that doesn't make it not original. It happened, but it's still an original film. It's based on an article, technically, but it's not quite the same as, you know, making a movie based on Moby Dick.
Right. Now, I've got some bad news for you, Michael.
What?
While we were recording just now, I got a little text message here. Gene Wilder, the actor, Willy Wonka. You know where I'm going with this.
I guess he died.
Yes, he's 83. Well, he was 83 years old. He passed away.
Well, he was not in great health, I don't think, in the last few years. But obviously sad to hear. His Hamlet is the comedy Hamlet is Young Frankenstein. So if you love Gene Wilder or haven't seen all his movies and you've never seen Young Frankenstein, that's the first thing that springs to mind for me. It's his masterpiece as an actor. He made a lot of pretty good, fun movies. That one is above them all.
That was 1974, Willy Wonka, 1971. Blazing Saddles, also 1974, a very good year for him. And then Stir Crazy in 1980.
Yeah, well, he had lots of other movies, too. You know, the producers, obviously. But to me, Young Frankenstein is just sublime. It's really just a great movie, and his performance is just pitch perfect.
Mel Brooks writing on Twitter 11 minutes ago, Gene Wilder, one of the truly great talents of our time. He blessed every film we did with his magic, and he blessed me with his friendship.
Well, that's very sweet. That's not a shock in the sense that he was a bit frail and not we didn't see him a lot in public and he wasn't working. So it's not a shock to me, though I certainly am not on top of his health. But what is a shock is the sudden death just today or over the weekend, the Mexican superstar Juan Gabriel. He died of a massive heart attack, 66 years old. His nickname is El Divo de Juarez, and he's been a major figure for decades. But really, frankly, in the last few months, he's been at a new peak in his career, which is saying something when you already have the biggest selling album in Mexican history, which was his Recuerdos Volume 2. His latest album just hit number one on the Latin Billboard charts. He was in the midst of the biggest tour of his career, which again, this guy is not he's toured a lot. So he really was at a huge peak and he just collapsed in an airport. So very sad news about Juan Gabriel dying very unexpectedly.
Now, speaking of recording artists, we do have a recording artist. In fact, we have an audio engineer, Rudy Van Gelder, passed away at the age of 91. And if his name isn't necessarily recognizable or a household name, it's because he was the audio engineer behind big, big jazz albums like John Coltrane's A Love Supreme, Miles Davis's Walkin', Herbie Hancock's Maiden Voyage, Sonny Rollins' Saxophone Colossus, and Songs for My Father by Horace Silver. This guy,
along with thousands more.
Thousands. I mean, he purposefully wanted people to know, I am not the producer. I'm not in charge of getting the musicians there or putting them in the room. I am in charge of recording and making the sound. So that sound of Blue Note Records, Blue Note Jazz, we have Rudy Van Gelder to thank for that because he was really the instrumental force in putting those records together when it came to the audio.
Yeah, he was a great engineer. He worked not just for Blue Note, but for Prestige and Impulse and lots of others. Obviously, the heyday for jazz was the 50s and 60s, and he was right in the heart of it. And you know he's like one of the greatest engineers of all time because CD reissues in the late 90s and the early 2000s, they started to have a series called the Rudy Van Gelder series. They put his name on like sort of as a defining way of grouping all these different albums and saying, ah, you know, newly remastered, newly done, overseen by Rudy. But Rudy's name was prominent right up there with these giants of music like John Coltrane and Miles Davis. That's how much people knew, wow, that guy was the real deal.
And working right up to the end, apparently.
Oh, that's cool.
Kind of like us. We're working right up to the end of this show.
Yeah, that's right. We already did our listener email, so I guess it's just time to move on to letting people know how they can contact us.
Well, they can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. They can call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up. And that's where Raul Buril sent us a link to the story about the number of people watching the record Olympics audience in Canada. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories that we've discussed on today's show, and including links to Kevin Lincoln's work from New York Magazine and Vulture. I'd like to thank him for joining us. Again, that information can be found on showbizsandbox.com, our website. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
I'm a blank. I'm drawing a blank.
.com. But, you know, if you can't find any of Michael's work on whatever that website was, why not head over to michaelgilts.com, where all of his work is aggregated, or you can read some of his coverage of the entertainment industry at the Huffington Post. And, of course, always check out bookfilter.com for some of his latest picks when it comes to books. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.